Thank you very much. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. Thank you for inviting me so many times to come to Perimeter. I hope the local people understand that if you invite a French citizen to Waterloo, he will have second thoughts. So, actually, I proved to be right, but thanks to the hospitality of Rob Myers, I'm saved. Okay, so I'm going to talk about my joint work with Samson Shatashvili over the last few years. And since this is the final talk, I will try to touch on the topics, at least on the topics which were mentioned in previous talks. So I'll start with a short review of what we call beta gauge correspondence. I first will state it in the physical terms, and then I'll try to give a mathematical flavor what it is, what this is about. So in physical terms, the claim is the following, that the supersymmetric ground states of gauge theories with two-dimensional (2, 2) supersymmetry are in one-to-one correspondence with the stationary states or eigenstates of quantum of a quantum integrable system. Sorry, so the ground states of a gauge theory with two-dimensional super Poincaré invariance are in one-to-one correspondence with the eigenstates of a quantum integrable system. So that's a statement which, in fact, although it sounds kind of deep, in fact, just the consequence of the supersymmetry algebra. What is extremely surprising is that there's some kind of notion of naturalness, that the natural gauge theories, so the gauge theories which you find in textbooks on supersymmetric theories and gauge theories, map to natural quantum integrable systems. So the the example which we like very much is the example of the 2D gauge theory with, let's say, UN gauge group. And L fundamental hypermultiplets, so that means the fundamental plus anti-fundamental chiral multiplet and the single adjoint. So it's better to say you start with a theory with n equals 4, 4 supersymmetry, and then you turn on twisted masses, the generic twisted masses, compatible with the superpotential, which I'll write schematically in this way. So this is for physicists. So phi is the in the adjoint in the vector multiplet. So when you start with this data, you end up, when you analyze the supersymmetric ground states, you end up with the eigenstates of the XXX Heisenberg spin chain. So it's a quantum mechanical system whose space of states is the tensor product of L copies. So L is the total number of spins So it's the quantum mechanical system whose Hilbert space is a tensor product of L copies of two-dimensional representation of the spin group SU2. And you have a bunch of operators which commute. So these are operators which act in this finite-dimensional Hilbert space. Among these operators, one of the operators is just the projection of the spin. So it's so that you fix to be n minus l over 2. So n, which is the number of colors of the gauge group, maps to the number of spins which point up. And so the resulting space, so that you get a subspace H sub n, the dimension of this space is L choose n. And it turns out that the common eigenstates of these Hamiltonians, which I will not write down, well, I will write down the second one. Okay, it's kind of famous. So sigmas are essentially the Pauli matrices. So the eigenstates of these Hamiltonians are in one-to-one correspondence with the supersymmetric ground states of this theory. Well, for mathematicians, this may sound too abstract. What this translates to in mathematical language is that the quantum cohomology of T star Grassmannian of n-dimensional planes in L-dimensional complex space is isomorphic to the algebra of integrals of motion of this Heisenberg spin chain. So quantum cohomology, as we know, is the commutative associative algebra, which depends on certain parameters. So here the parameters are the generator of the second cohomology of the Grassmannian, which is one-dimensional, and then the equivariant parameters, which corresponds to the action of the group GL, L, and C star, which rotates the fibers. So these are the generic twisted masses which you can turn on, and that's a claim. So that's, if you actually familiar with the story of these quantum spin chains and what kind of symmetry algebra acts there, namely, in this case, it's the Youngian of SL2, you get the Braid group representation for free, and among other things. So that's one of the consequences of these dualities. You can start with this example, actually, and generalize in various directions. You can go up in dimension of the space-time of your gauge theory. You see, I was careful in formulating the main principle. My theory, my gauge theory, doesn't have to be a two-dimensional theory. I only require it to have a two-dimensional super Poincaré invariance. So you could take, for example, the three-dimensional theory, compactify it on a circle, and then what you will get would be the what physicists call the XXZ Heisenberg spin chain. And for mathematicians, that's the setting for the representation theory of the quantum affine algebra of SL2. So here, this Hamiltonian, one of these Hamiltonians is deformed. And there is some relation between this anisotropy parameter and the radius of the circle and the masses which you turn on. So it depends on R. And then you can also go up to four dimensions, and then you will get, as you can guess, the elliptic quantum groups as the representation, as the symmetry generating algebras. and so on and so forth. And then you can consider the gauge theories with more complicated gauge groups. For example, you can take the quiver gauge theories, and then you would get the results about the quantum homology of cotangent bundles to various flag varieties in particular, or more generally quiver varieties. Now, so all these models, which in some sense are simple suspensions in the sense of a direct topology of the two-dimensional theories, they lead to the quantum systems, which are the spin chains, which correspond to fixed, fixed particles, which only interact through the internal degrees of freedom by some kind of exchange interaction. I promised to explain what does it mean mathematically to start with this description and end up with the problem of the common eigenvectors of commutative Hamiltonians. Let me try to explain this in this example. So, mathematically, what you might do if you want to stay in two-dimensional context, you can construct, you can study the intersection theory, equivariant intersection theory on the moduli space of solutions to a certain system of PDEs. We can call them the generalized vortex equations. Or generalized Hitchin equations, if you like. So the data are the Riemann surface. That's the wall sheet of the two-dimensional gauge theory. A principal G bundle. With some connection A. And and then you have matter fields. So I will denote them collectively by the letter X. So these are the sections of various associated bundles. So for any we fix some representation of G, which is not necessarily reducible. In fact, it's kind of interesting when it is not reducible. So if I split it if I decompose it into irreducible representations, then what I do, I will take the associated vector bundles over sigma, which are associated with irreducible components, Ri's, and then I will twist the multiplicity spaces by some natural vector bundles on sigma. So this could be some powers of the canonical bundle, or the sums of powers of canonical bundles. So there are some choices here. So I will say roughly these are powers of. So the the famous case, of course, is that of the Hitchin system, where you simply have the representation is the adjoint representation, or rather its complexification, and then this twisting bundle is the canonical bundle on the curve. But when you start talking about theories with various matter fields, you actually have more than this. And then you impose some compatibility conditions, which I will summarize. Well, you actually also need a function W, which is a function from R to C, or from the composition of this representation to C, which has to have some homogeneity property. So that when you twist, so there's some condition on these alphas, which I will not bother to spell out explicitly. So then the equations which you impose would roughly look as follows, that the 0-1 component of the covariant derivative of the matter field with respect to the connection A, so this is 0-1, if you like, has to be equal to the derivative of the conjugate super potential with respect to the conjugate field, and then we use some Hermitian metric. And then there is a condition that the curvature of the gauge field is equal essentially to the moment map. So this is the moment map. So I'm using the fact that on the complexification representation, you can introduce the Hermitian structure, the corresponding Cayley structure, which will be all invariant under the action of the compact group G. And so this gives you the set of equations. So this twisting and the homogeneity of W have to be compatible in such a way that this equation actually makes sense, so that the left-hand side and the right-hand side take values in the same space. So, for example, in the example of this, which is related to the Grassmannian, which I talked about, so your matter fields live in the fundamental representation, taking L copies. Well, adjoint. So after twisting, phi becomes the one form on the wall sheet. And these are still scalars. So you get this modulus, so you have this modulus space of solutions to these equations. W was a cubic function, so W was this Q tilde phi Q. So that when you differentiate with respect to phi, you get a scalar on the wall sheet, but if you differentiate with respect to Q or Q tilde, you get 1-0 form. And if you take a conjugate, you get 0-1 form. And that's what you need here. If you take a covariant derivative of Q, you have to get a 0-1 form. So that's compatible. Okay. So these are the non-abelian generalizations of the vortex equations, which we heard about yesterday. In general, we don't know much about them, except that if we have some multiplicities here, we have a symmetry group which acts on them. So you can devise an equivariant intersection theory. So, for example, already in the Hitchin case, you can multiply the field phi by a phase, and that's the famous symmetry of Hitchin's equation, which is useful. So in general, you can do a similar story, and what you will arrive at... Well, you have a projection, which is kind of... actually not so easy to define, but so it's easy to define it generically. Namely, you take this data, A, X, and so on, and you just project the class of A. So you take the 0-1 part of the gauge field and take its gauge equivalence class with respect to the complexified gauge transformations. So the usual story is that instead of imposing this condition, which is a kind of stability condition, you divide the space of solutions of the first equations by the complexified gauge group. So here, if you stay away from the unstable locus, you have a projection from this modular space of solutions to these equations to the space of holomorphic stable bundles, to the modular space of holomorphic stable bundles. And therefore, if you were to integrate something over the space MH, and gauge theory actually... what it gives you it gives you in some sense the integral in sense of a covariant cohomology. The integral of one, so that you can write up to some complications. So this is a projection pi. As the integral of a certain cohomology class or, well, virtual sort of localized cohomology class, localized in the sense of localization in covariant cohomology, of over this the space bound G. Now, what kind of cohomology the module space of bundles on the surface on the curve has? Well, these are the so-called mu classes. Namely, so bound G parameterizes bundles. So if you take a product of bound G and the curve, now a mu within the surface is a curve, there is a universal bundle. Well, okay. I'm not being careful here. So there is a stacky version of that, but for the moment I will just do. I pretend that I'm staying away from the unstable bundles. And what you can do formally, you take any characteristic class of P, and then you can push it forward along any homology cycle of sigma. So this way, to any gauge invariant, so to any invariant polynomial on the Lie algebra, you associate several classes of bound G, which physicists call, well, the most interesting one is what we call usually two observable. So this is the integral along the fundamental cycle, so all of sigma of the characteristic class of P, which corresponds to this function W tilde. So, and also you could get for some other function, let me call it V tilde, you could get zero observable, which is just the same, well, characteristic class corresponding to V, just evaluated at some point. It doesn't matter at which point of sigma. So, if you think about it, you get this class P star of one, so the push forward of one, which is essentially the, well, if you think about bound G as sitting inside of MH as a zero section, as a space of solutions where X vanishes, then this is essentially one over the Euler class of the normal bundle. So this is some kind of it looks like it's not something you can divide by, but because it's all in covariant cohomology, this actually has a well-defined meaning. But you can also ask, so can you express this in terms of the in terms of these mu classes? And if you think a little bit about it, use the index theory, I mean the Riemann-Roch-Grothendieck, then you can rewrite it as a sum of as exponential over two observable corresponding to a certain function W tilde, and a zero observable corresponding to some other function V tilde. And W tilde and V tilde are entirely, well, what they depend on, the choice of our matter fields and the choice of covariant parameters. They actually do not depend on the choice of the superpotential W. So this is W tilde is what physicists call twisted, effective twisted superpotential. And this procedure of taking the push forward from the space of solutions of Higgs equations with matter fields down to the module space of gauge bundles is called the integrating out the massive matter fields. So So I try to summarize for mathematicians what do we mean when we say that we integrate out massive degrees of freedom and arrived at effective twisted superpotential. So in all these models, this is something which you can do, and then it turns out that you can recognize in twisted superpotential what is known to another crowd of people as the Young-Young counting function. Of quantum integrable system. So, by going through the list of various interesting gauge theories, which differ by the choice of the gauge group and the matter contents, get a list of these superpotentials, effective twisted superpotentials, and then you realize that you've seen this list before. It's in some other place. So, well, just to remind you what this function is, in the example of the Heisenberg spin chain, in 1931, I think, Hans Bethe, actually proposed an ansatz for constructing the eigenstates of this spin chain. And this ansatz involved some kind of superposition of plane waves. So you take an excitation and then you flip it consecutively at various spin sites. And then you take a linear combination which corresponds to Hamiltonian plane wave. So it's characterized by, these plane waves are characterized by the momentum. So x is the is a discrete coordinate on the lattice. And Bethe arrived at a system of equations on this momenta, which gave you consistent, which were consistent, first of all, and they, which actually gave the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. It turned out that it was convenient to parameterize this momenta in terms of another variable, which was appreciated much later in the context of relativistic systems, which we call now rapidity. And so the Bethe equations, which describe the spectrum, are the equations for these rapidities, which roughly have this form. That's in the simplest case. So I'm just so this is an equation for n real numbers. It actually might become complex, but the simplest situation there are just real numbers. So it's a system of n equations for on n numbers. And it's remarkable that these equations are actually, these are not some kind of random equations. These equations are actually equivalent. They have a potential, in other words. So you can write a function W tilde of n variables, lambda 1, lambda n. Well, now that I said this, you can actually guess what this function would look like. It would be a bunch of things like that, probably, and then I'm making this usual mistake of calling the index and the imaginary unit by the same letter. You can check that if you differentiate this with respect to lambda I and then exponentiate, you'll get the equation for the index I. And so these equations are all sort of consistent because essentially these are the equations. All, you can think of them as the equations for the critical point of a certain function. And actually, just like in an analysis of special metrics where you find some functional whose minimization or critical point gives you a special metric, having this functional was useful for Young and Young, actually, in establishing that you get a unique solution given some boundary conditions and so on and so forth. So it is this function which we identify with the twist potential of the gauge theory. So lambdas here are mapped to the eigenvalues of a field in the adjoint in the vector multiplet in the adjoint representation. So it has eigenvalues for the gauge group UN. And then these guys are the contributions of the fundamental and anti-fundamental fields. And this is a contribution of the adjoint matter field. So the structure which you see is just the structure of the roots and weights of the various matter representations. Okay, so it was for a while we thought that, well, these are some curious examples which didn't have any. Well, first of all, the spin chains among the quantum integral systems, they're kind of peculiar systems because they're sort of inherently quantum. Spin 1/2, is, even though it's a simple system by itself, it's a very long way from some classical mechanical system of which you quantized and arrived at this particular system. So we wanted to have an example where you start with a classical mechanical system, and then you quantize it, and that this quantum system would actually have a parameter, a continuous parameter, which we could call it Planck constant. So these models, for these models, the Planck constant is essentially discrete. It's the inverse spin. And so we thought that by trying to answer this question, we would come up with interesting examples of gauge theories, perhaps. And it turned out that indeed, if you go to a textbook, to a textbook on quantum integrable systems, you find that there are actually two classes of integrable systems. So one is this spin chains, which I already talked about, which are favored by one group of people, and another are many-body systems, which describe the motion, now the continuous motion, mostly in one dimensions, but some people manage to go higher. Let's say of particles on a line, which have some kind of interaction. So the simplest such model is the Calogero-Moser-Sutherland. It has the Hamiltonian, so the phase space of this model is just the space of P's and Q's. And so Q lives on the line, and I will not specify for the moment whether it's a real line or a complex line. And then the Hamiltonian, there is a first Hamiltonian, which is just the total momentum. And then the second Hamiltonian is quadratic in momenta, and it contains the interaction terms. So these particles, they sort of, in most examples, they just repel each other. And so there is some kind of repulsion, which in the original example of Calogero, it was just the inverse square potential, which, among other things, has the scaling symmetry. So people interested in conformal quantum mechanics like this example for that reason. Then it was generalized in several interesting ways. You can make your particles live on the circle. And so then the natural repulsion will be 1 over sine square. Or you can make them live on the line. And you may want to make them actually be almost free when they're far away from each other, so that make this potential decay faster than 1 over x squared. So here they live on the line. And the potential is exponentially decaying. And the last option, well, the kind of the most general one, is to have the elliptic function. So I always called it the Weierstrass P function, but now that after the Friday's talk, now I know I should call it P function. So I hope it will pay eventually. So nu is a coupling constant. Well, it's a parameter which determines the coupling constant. And when people analyzed these models in these trigonometric cases and rational cases, they discovered that the behavior of the wave functions and behavior of the particles which interact with these potentials depends on the value of nu in an interesting way, that if nu goes to 1, you get free fermions. Nu goes to 0, you get free bosons. And otherwise, you get something which is called anions. And so people working in quantum Hall effect like these models because they describe the fractional statistics. You see that in the form of the ground state wave function, which is essentially the van der Waals of q's raised to the power nu. And so if you exchange this, if you exchange two particles, you pick up a phase which corresponds to this anion statistics. Now, so this P function has two periods. And so typically you take tau to be in the upper half plane. So it is natural to impose the periodic boundary conditions on your wave function. And ask for the spectrum. So you get a problem of n particles interacting with a repulsive potential in the finite volume. It definitely will have a discrete spectrum. And then by the spectrum, I mean the spectrum of the Hamiltonian H2, H1. And in fact, it turns out that there is a whole sequence of Hamiltonians, which are independent in the sense that, let's say, the symbols are independent, functionally independent functions on the phase space, which commute. And so you can study the problem of simultaneous diagonalization of these functions. And it turns out that you can find, so even though this is not a spin chain and the techniques which were developed by the Metandas people for the spin chains do not actually apply here, or at least not in a general case, you can find the analog of the Young-Young function. And it turns out that it's a gauge theory which helps you to find it. Well, okay. So how do you do? So how would you proceed if you didn't know anything about the gauge theory and anything about what I said so far? So how would you actually? How could you approach the problem of finding the spectrum of this Hamiltonian? Well, there are two options. You can suppose that tau, the coupling constant tau, is very large. sorry, the not the coupling constant, the second period of the elliptic curve. Is very large. Then this P function approaches 1 over sine squared function. And for this model, the spectrum is known. And wave functions are related, are given essentially by the so-called Jack polynomials. So you could just do the perturbation theory. You start with the problem with discrete spectrum, and then you just find small corrections in, which will be the corrections in e to the 2 pi I tau, which is usually called Q. Well, that's a possible approach. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any interesting structure in this perturbation theory. So some people actually went rather far in these computations, like Langman, for example, in Sweden, but it's not clear whether this can be summarized in some neat statement. Another option is to actually is to do something crazy, actually, is to study a different, is to study the problem where you look for the wave function which is periodic in the tau direction. So you do not treat one as the physical period. If you like, you can do the S-duality and map tau to minus 1 over tau, and that will be equivalent. And then this P function will approach the hyperbolic sign, 1 over sine sinh squared. So here the spectrum is also known. And it is continuous. So this is discrete. It's continuous because here the particles move on an infinite line, and when you separate them far away, the potential is absolutely negligible, so you are free to have particles moving with arbitrary asymptotic momentum. And so you can construct the wave function which will be labeled by n asymptotic momenta. With some sum of permutations, with some factors. These factors, by the way, are known as Harish-Chandra C function, and they were computed in, long before these models were formulated as quantum mechanical problems. So they showed up in harmonic analysis, and very famous people are associated with these functions. In particular, by analyzing these functions, you can find what is this S matrix, the scattering matrix of two such particles when they're far away. So if you have two particles interacting with the inverse sinh square potential, so you start with configuration when you have some asymptotic moment lambda 1, lambda 2, you scatter them because of the conservation of because of the conservation laws, the only thing which can happen is that they can exchange momentum. So actually, they do not cross, they repel from each other, so that's the picture which will happen. And the wave function will require a phase shift, which is also known as the S matrix. And it takes the following form. So the numerator is complex conjugate of the denominator. So this is a scattering phase. So what you could do, you could try to, if you want to analyze that now, the full problem with elliptic potential, you could first, so you have this problem on a circle of a very large size, where the size is tau. You can assume that your particles are almost free. So you assign some initial momenta, lambda 1, lambda 2, and so on. And then you impose the consistency condition very much like the original beta condition, that if you take one of these particles, so here I took lambda I, and then scattering all the rest of the particles, and then bring it back, you should get the same wave function. And so that gives you what is known as asymptotic beta ansatz equation, which takes on the following form. Where S is this S matrix. Let me specify it depends on you. So this is an equation on the momenta. It has some discrete set of solutions, and this describes the, so this will describe the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. For example, A2 will be in this limit just the sum of the squares. And this will be exact up to the corrections, which are the integer powers of Q. So if you want to find the solution which, if you want to sum of over all inverse powers of tau, one over tau is a small parameter, if you want to sum up all the inverse powers of tau, but you don't want to keep track of the exponentially small terms, so Q is the exponentially small term, then that's the only thing which you need to do. So that gives you the asymptotic. Yes. One less sine squared, you don't actually do the beta ansatz. You do the, so you can just write down the wave function. Yes, actually, yes. But so in the one over sine squared, there is no, I mean, okay, so you should be careful with what you call the S matrix in that case, because then, so it's, this is not sin squared, it's a sine squared. What do you say? Oh, you want 1/r². Okay, so even in that case, so if you take 1/x² instead of the sin, you don't get this S matrix. What you get will be just the, I think just the phase, minus 1 to the nu. Right, so you can assign it to this side. So you can then write the ansatz in this form, and that will give the correct spectrum, actually. The so-called Haldane exclusion principle, we can recover from that. No, it's not obvious, and in fact, it's rather hard to justify it because, I mean, there is no reason why for the potential, which is 1/x², the asymptotic analysis would work at all. Here it's very different because here I'm in a much better shape because this is exponentially fast decaying potential. So that's, in what cases? No, this is not a, no, but you see, the point is that this is not the full potential. Yeah. Yes, right? Right. No, but it is better, but it is a scattering picture for the bare potential. You need to dress it up with all corrections, and that's dressing which will eventually lead to all this exponential small corrections. That's life. So you don't get, I mean, so I'm just saying that if you were a naive quantum mechanical person, and that's most likely what you would have arrived at in analysis of this problem. And then you can ask, okay, now you stare at these equations, you can ask, is there some Young function? Are these equations the equations for the critical point of some functional of lambdas? Are they at all consistent? It's not obvious. And the answer is yes. And that, after you realize what the answer is, it's easy to come up with a consistent scheme for all the corrections. So it turns out that this W tilde, well, it's not difficult to compute it, actually. So, this is a bad letter. Let's call it omega. So this omega, it's a function whose first derivative is the logarithmic derivative of the gamma function. So you stare at this function, and you can ask. It could be identified with some effective superpotential, to the superpotential of a theory which has adjoint fields, perhaps because you can recognize in these formulas the just the roots of GLN. So you are looking for the gauge theory. With adjoint matter. Now, because of this difference, you assume that the matter fields are such that they partially compensate the effect of the gauge fields, perhaps. In fact, when mu is equal to 1, or maybe to 0, they should completely screen the one the other. So it's tending to identify new decoupling constant to be proportional to the mass of some matter fields, so that and this matter is such that in the limit when the mass goes to zero, you get probably an enhancement of supersymmetry, which would explain why you don't get any of these corrections. And then you also see that you have this elliptic parameter tau, which is a kind of a coupling constant. And the gauge theory should be such that the fact that this coupling constant is parameterized elliptic curves has to be natural. So sooner or later, you convince yourself that this theory has to be some version of the n equals to 4 supernormals theory with gauge group un, which is broken down to n equals to 2 by giving the mass term, the mass proportional to nu, to the adjoint, to the Hypermod split. This is known as n equals to 2 star theory. And actually, if you look at the four-dimensional n equals to 2 star theory, it has the low energy effective action, which is governed by a certain prepotential, which is, as you've probably learned from Andy's talk, should correspond to some complex integrable system living on whose phase space is actually a hypercalorie manifold. And in fact, this system, so there is a classical integrable system, which was in 95 1995 shown by Benagi and Witten to be a particular case of the Hitchin system. Which corresponds to the elliptic curve with the puncture, with certain boundary conditions at this puncture, which actually in 1994 was shown by Gorsky and myself to be equivalent to that system with the elliptic potential. Well, precisely in the gay, actually in the classical system, the coupling constant is just nu, is equal to nu squared. You don't see the subtle shift by one. So what we seem to be getting here is that somehow this four-dimensional gauge theory has a potential of capturing the spectrum not only of the classical system, which is now a 15-year-old result, but also a quantum system. But we need to do something to it, because I said that just the structure of these terms suggests looking at this theory, but I didn't tell you what you should do to this theory to arrive at this structure. After all, when we talk about the n equals 4 theories, n equals 2 theories, especially n equals 4 theory, we never talk about twisted superpotentials, especially of some complicated nature. So, okay, so this is the last statement. Because of lack of time, it's easier actually for me to explain it mathematically than physically what the statement is. So you take four-dimensional gauge theory. On, let's say, the Riemann surface cross R2. And now let's consider, let's work equivariantly with respect to the rotations of R2. So there is some physical realization of this equivariant business, but mathematically what you are doing mathematicians are familiar with taking n equals 2 theories in four dimensions, twisting them, and that produces a Donaldson theory on four manifolds, or its generalization if you have matter fields. Now, if your four manifold has isometries, for example, it has a form sigma cross R2, and R2 has flat metric, you can generalize Donaldson theory to the equivariant Donaldson theory. And then, so you can think of it as a kind of a deformation of the original theory with the deformation parameter epsilon. Now, as in usual equivariant cohomology business, you can try to localize with respect to the symmetry group action. And so, if you can do that here, you would localize the four-dimensional theory you will get some effective two-dimensional theory which lives on the Riemann surface sigma. And the amount of supersymmetry of this two-dimensional theory is precisely 2, 2, and so it ought to have a twisted subpotential which will be a function of lambda, which is also identified with what usually we call A, the Coulomb branch moduli. The coupling, whatever couplings in four dimensions your gauge theory has, whatever masses this theory has, and on this parameter epsilon. And in particular, in the limit when epsilon goes to zero, if you try to recover the four-dimensional theory, the superpotential would behave like prepotential of the four-dimensional theory. So that limit, the limit when you remove the equivariance with respect to rotations, corresponds to the quasi-classical limit. So this epsilon is identified with the Planck constant of the quantum system, the mass is identified essentially with nu times h bar, and electron set h bar to 1. and then this W can be computed. So if you actually repeat this analysis with push forwards, which is almost the same as the analysis which I did in two-dimensional case, you can relate this function W tilde to what is called the instanton partition function of the four-dimensional theory. And so this part turns out to be just the one loop four-dimensional computation. And just as for prepotential, there are no higher loop corrections, there are only instanton corrections. So this W tilde can be recovered from the full instanton partition function by taking a certain limit. And, well, this is not the first time when I attempt to explain that out of this, that is by taking this limit that you arrive at the thermodynamic Betanzas equations, but it's not the first time that I run out of time. So. Thank you. So these are, so the sorry, lattice, you say lattice or what? These are not lattice fermions. These are particles which move on a continuous circle. This is a non-relativistic system, and it is even more and it's kind of surprising that you get the TBA, which usually people expect to get in relativistic systems, but actually it doesn't have to be relativistic. In the original work of Young and Young, actually, when they first wrote the thermodynamics beta and Zas equations, they were analyzing non-relativistic systems as well. It's just that the context here, it looks like you're describing the spectrum of an n-particle system. So it's a system with finite number of degrees of freedom, yet you find the equations which typically correspond to describing the states with a finite number of excitations in the field theory, in one plus fundamental theory, so with infinite number of degrees of freedom. So that actually suggests two things. First of all, it suggests that these quantum mechanical systems with finite number of degrees of freedom, which people thought about for a long time as just the ordinary quantum mechanics, should probably be viewed as a dynamics of some n-solitons in QFT. And second of all, it suggests that the gauge theory, in this UN gauge theory, well, for people who work on D-brains, this should not come as a surprise, but if you're just a gauge theorist, it should come to you as a surprise that you should think of a UN gauge theory as of a kind of a bound state of N individual constituents. And so this theory suggests that, at least when you look at the ground states, the supersymmetric ground states, of the theories which you subject to rather exotic boundary conditions, they still behave as a kind of bound states of N constituents. Yes? It does, yeah. Now this TBA, so you get the TBA when you conclude both the perturbative and non-perturbative corrections. So this is a full partition function. So you can ignore the TBA nature of these equations. You could just solve them iteratively like you do with the ordinary TBA, and then you just get corrections, these fine size corrections one by one. But it's somehow we believe that there is a TBA presentation should be useful. Right, so they actually had an infinite number of particles, so to speak, but here it looks like we have a finite number of particles, yet we have these equations, which suggest that the reason why you have a thermodynamic here is that again, there is some, presumably, 1+1 theory behind it, and you use the usual modular transform trick to arrive at equations for the spectrum. So it's an infinite number of particles in a different channel. Something which some people call mirror, which I find confusing name for this procedure.